This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Ah, if it was only that land today. It will be one of these days. But as we talked a couple of programs ago, Christians, foolishly, celebrate Christmas by opening presents. Jews, foolishly, celebrate Hanukkah by lighting candles. Muslims celebrate Ramadan by killing Jews. It is a special religion. And what is so remarkable about all of this is that Islamic countries and progressive statesmen are calling Israel's ambassadors into their office to scold them on telling the Jews that they are exacerbating the problem, that they ought not be escalating this, that the Palestinians, they're right in being able to prevent Jews from going onto the Temple Mount, and that the Jews are wrong when they arrest people who are trying to murder others. It's a world that's gone mad. It's just clearly obvious that the Temple Mount is a Jewish site. It was purchased by Dod, who was a Yehud. The home of Yahweh was built by Solomon, a Yehud. It was part of Judea from 3000 BCE. Even part of Judea, as the Greeks and Romans controlled the province. It was the province of Judea, of Yehuda. It's always been Jewish. It isn't a holy site for Muslims. It is a disgrace for Muslims. And unfortunately, progressives are too dim-witted to study the history of why Muslims consider it their third holiest site. And I've been over this so many times, I'm not going to repeat it, but it is a complete embarrassment to Islam to claim Jerusalem, and yet they will riot and kill, thinking they're doing the right thing, and the heads of state will encourage them to lash out and kill Jews. It's how far we have fallen intellectually with the religious and progressive leading the way to a wholesale stupidity. Speaking of stupidity, the United States, with its comatose president and progressive piece of worm rot as vice president, as well as a anti-Semitic secretary of state. And I don't like political authority. I hate religious authority. But we have really reached the absolute bottom with the threesome between our weekended Bernie's president, our absolutely incompetent vice president, and this current Secretary of State. It was obvious to me even before we witnessed what occurred, because we had several months to assess the situation, that the notion that America pulled off of the table any discussion about precluding Ukraine from becoming part of NATO and their unwillingness to discuss not weaponizing the Ukraine, who they had, you know, our country, the United States, had created through a coup, an anti-Russian country, which was previously pro-Russian, that was not going to work, that was going to be a prelude to war. I knew it before it happened. I talked about it on this program. So when it happened, exactly as I had said, that by pulling off the only things that diplomatically that mattered, precluding Ukraine from being part of NATO and to cease weaponizing the Ukraine, led to war, you would have thought that the administration of the United States and all of the morons that are parroting the United States, particularly the progressives, would have shut up and said, okay, well, that didn't work. Why don't we try a different approach? What they turned to was sanctions. And now, after imposing sanction upon sanction upon sanction, we went to the gas station to fill up our car today, and we paid nearly $7 a gallon. Food prices are up 40% over what they were 6 months ago. So by imposing sanctions, have we changed the status quo of what's occurring in the Ukraine? No. Only getting worse. And who are we punishing? Ourselves.
Pardon.
You know,
yes.
Biden said, oh, you know, sanctions aren't to deter. They're to punish. They're to create pain. Well, the pain he's creating is in America. So when the sanctions had a counterproductive effect, you would have thought that we would have stopped imposing sanctions and come up with a different plan. But no, we just continue to impose more sanctions. You would have thought when the United States first decided that the solution here was to provide the Ukraine with more weapons, and that led to the wholesale destruction of cities, that we would have said, you know, that's a really bad idea. Because if you supply the Ukraine with anti-tank and anti-personnel and anti-aircraft weapons, then what choice do the Russians have but to bombard the cities from afar and be indiscriminate? But that's what we've done. So what did we decide to do? Rather than admit we were wrong, do more of that. Somewhere along the way, when we are continuing to threaten and besmirch Putin and use the ad hominem argument to describe what is occurring as opposed to a sensible assessment of world affairs and compare it to things that have transpired in the past, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, that you would realize that continuing to besmirch Putin and villainize Putin isn't working, making the situation worse. So you'd think a reasonable, rational person would stop doing it. But I'm not sure there are any reasonable and rational people, not on the right, not on the left, not in the center. They don't exist anymore. And that's the problem of our world. But it's worse than all of that. We have still not dealt with the fact that Russia has the most nuclear weapons, more even than the United States. And collectively, between the United States and Russia, it's about 95% of the world's total. And we continue to push and kill.
Goad. Mm-hmm.
Goad, the nation that has the most nuclear weapons. What do you think is going to happen when you continue to push the wrong buttons and push Russia into a corner where there is the only option is to bring down the rest of the world with it? I am so stunned that we continue to do the wrong thing for the wrong reason, and that so many people are incapable of understanding what is transpiring here. But it's very much like crediting the Pakistanians with their resistance and condemning the Jews for having the gall to send in police to arrest those who would kill their citizens. And even giving the Pakistanians who want to destroy them and kill them the right to vote in their country, paying for their education, paying for their medical care, paying for their roads, providing them with electricity, providing them with water, providing them with the sustenances of life and more freedoms than they have in any Islamic country, and yet they're condemned and killed for doing so. Well, that's my commentary on the news. Kirk, do you have anything to add to that, or feel free to?
No, there's no. It's all no. It's all bad. I mean, the economy sucks.
It does.
We just yeah. Oh, I'll
we
say
were
one
right.
other thing about Russia.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. No,
go
I was
ahead.
Just going to say there was an article that came out where the administration canceled the ability for the Russians to use U.S. dollars that were in banks, their money in American banks, to pay down their debts that they owe on bonds. So the people that all the Americans who bought the bonds, which was 90-something percent of them, they can't get paid. So
right.
thanks a lot, pal.
Oh, yeah. We have
absolute
ignoramuses destroying the economy. This is where we were in our program 2 weeks ago before we took time out for PSOC. For those of you who, like us, celebrated PSOC beginning on Friday, a week ago, this is now the seventh day, and we are back to having completed Chag Matzah. Chag Matzah is my favorite time of the year, so I would have no problem. We could continue to have lamb and wine and matzah with bitter herbs, and we could continue to do that for the next month, and I'd be delighted. But we have completed the 7 day cycle of Chag Matzah. Before we return to where we were, I told you, Kirk, leading the show, that I have been translating Yeshaya 52 and 53 and writing commentary on it. And we will get to what I have learned but in a future program. But one of the things I just wanted to share is that man's perception of what occurred in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE, with the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkotim, is really the fulcrum upon which our relationship with God pivots. I don't think that apart from the translations that I've done and the commentary that I've written and those who are part of our covenant family, that apart from us, no one has gotten this right for a better part of 3,000 years. Now, certainly since the last of the prophets, which would be Malachi 2,450 years ago. Religious Jews are so lost in this regard, they actually despise, they condemn, they besmirch. They refer to the Passover lamb as if he were Satan incarnate. That's how aggressively hostile they are to the notion that Yahweh fulfilled Pesach in your 4,000 Yah as he has promised. They no longer celebrate matzah. They eat matzah. They make matzah part of Passover, but as a Moed Mikre, no. I have got no clue as to what either of these 2 days, Pesach or Matzah, represent. and they're hostile to it. Then, of course, they don't celebrate Bukhuram or Shavua. Christians are so lost, they turn the Passover lamb into a god. Now, I can guarantee you, having read the story, the Passover lamb is not a god. Pharaoh's not a god. Moshe is not a god. Passover lamb's not a god. There is but one God, and he most certainly ain't the lamb. And so those are the two biggest religions, the two religions God is most concerned about. And, of course, if you take Islam, Muhammad left what was really Petra, but we've been led to believe it was Mecca, in shame following the satanic verses after having ridden the wild Barak, the winged ass, from Petra. Well, it wouldn't have been as long a flight anyway from Petra to Jerusalem. But after claiming that all of Allah's messengers speak on behalf of Satan, he hightailed it to Yathrib in shame. And on his approach to Yathrib, since he couldn't get those in Petra, let's pretend it was Mecca, to believe that he was a messenger of God, three-quarters of the population of Yathrib were Jews. And so he tried to convince them that he was their long-awaited Messiah. And so it was a misunderstanding of who Dode is and Yahusha was that served as the impetus for year one of the Islamic era. He went so far talking about the person he thought was the Messiah. Esau is the Arabic transliteration, which is really a transliteration of Esau. Stupid is as stupid does. He said that the Messiah actually did not get killed because, you know, the idea of killing one of Allah's messengers was not appealing to Muhammad. He just faked his death. So all three religions grew out of this. It was Jews doing everything they could deny the fulfillment of Pesach that really is the impetus of Judaism. Judaism begins really with Yosha's death. And Christianity begins with Yosha's death.
Yes.
And Islam is the first year of the Islamic era is based upon a misunderstanding of Yosef's sacrifice and death. It is the fulcrum upon which man's relationship with God pivots in the wrong direction.
Amazing.
And as I'm translating these things, I not only recognize that, but to recognize how what happened on Pesach in 33 CE, while vitally important, is just one of seven acts in God's play. And religious Jews and Christians alike are clueless as to what those acts are. And we'll get into them in a future program.
Okay.
So this is where we were in Yaketz El, God Grows, Ezekiel 43:8, I think, Kirk.
Yes, sir.
With them offering, Ba Nathan Him, with them appointing, their doorway, he's speaking of rabbis here, and threshold, Chef Hem, their approach and entrance, juxtaposed against and in opposition to Eth, my doorway and threshold, Seraph, Adi, my approach and entrance, and their door frame, Mezuzah, Hem, the framework of the doorway which provides access to a home, beside Etzel, my door frame, Mezuzah Ani. So now there is this wall between me and them. Before we consider the rest of this, what God is saying is that the way that Judaism went about establishing itself is not to create something new and different where they can say, hey, you know, pay no attention to that God over there. We got a better idea over here. That's not how Judaism is created. It instead said, okay, So, you know, we recognize that Yahweh has a doorway, that's Passover, and we recognize he has a threshold, that's matzah. We don't much like his. So we're going to create our own variations of his, and we're going to place ours right on top of his. So we'll continue to celebrate Passover. It's just going to be a different thing. Hell with the lamb. We'll put a zero on the plate that you can't eat. Chip a tooth. Fill the plate with vegetables. Matzah will become the missing ingredient, but we won't celebrate it. But we'll leave the term so that our threshold is placed right against God's. And think about it for a moment.
Yes.
Yahweh put his nephesh consciousness. What is the consciousness? It's ability to observe, to experience the environment around you and respond to it. Yahweh put his nephesh conscience into Yosha so that he could observe, he could feel, he could smell, he could taste, he could see, he could hear what was done to him on Pesach. And so he could experience what it was like to be tormented in Sheol. It's just like man can't go to Mars. We can't endure the ride there. We couldn't live on the planet. We couldn't come back. But we sure as heck can send a probe. And that probe has the ability to see, to smell, to hear, to taste. It can do all of those things. We have projected ourselves onto Mars with these rovers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, imagine a probe that God creates, infinitely superior. And it's that probe that is what the nephesh represents when he sets his nephesh inside of Yosha. And so you've got God himself experiencing the abuse that man inflicted upon him as the Passover lamb, and then the abuse the adversary inflicted upon him in Sheol. And you do that to redeem your people, to save your people, to reconcile them onto you. And your people go way beyond ignoring what you've done. They besmirch it. They call your participation in Pesach an abomination. And then the most popular religion turns the damn lamb into a god. Don't you think that God's a little irritated? Just a little? Can you imagine doing all of that for your people and they slap you in the face? I say, no, we got a better idea. That's what he's saying here. That's the problem of Judaism. It isn't a means to endear oneself to God. It's a means to irritate God. God's more irritated by Judaism than he is by Christianity, only because Judaism is more lethal to his people, and Christians have never been his people. Wrong, yes. His people, no. They defiled, they vandalized, they besmirched my set-apart name. Oh, God. Isn't that true? Yeah. They claim that, we have such reverence for the name that we can't say it. No, you despise it. And you know you despise it. You have vandalized it because you've removed it from his Torah and prophets. You've defiled it with Adonai and Hashem. Shame on you. Who in the hell do you think you are to remove God's name from his testimony? His name is Yahweh. Oh, this myth that nobody knows for certain how to pronounce it. Can you pronounce Haya, the basis of his name?
Yes.
Can you pronounce Torah, which is the guidance and teaching regarding his name? Can you pronounce Shalom, Of course. And
yes,
those words prove that the name is pronounced Yahweh. It does not take a rocket scientist to figure this out. But that's how they have defiled, vandalized, and besmirched my set-apart name with their detestable abominations and repulsive religion, Ba'toa Bahim, which they have engaged in. To say that Judaism is an abomination is viewed by many as anti-Semitic. It's exactly the opposite. Judaism is anti-Semitic. It's against the name. That's what God just said. Shem mm-hmm. is the name. Anti means against. Judaism is anti-Semitic. It is against the name. To be against Judaism is to be in favor of the name of God.
Well put.
So, I have grown weary of them, and I have decided that they should perish in my resentment and animosity. Considering what Yahweh did for his people, the sacrifice he made to fulfill Pesach and Matzah, leading to Bukkurim and Shavuot, and then considering how his people spit in his face, how they label his fulfillment of Pesach and Matzah as satanic, how Judaism is literally based on denouncing and denying what happened on those 2 days in year 4000, Yah. God suffered for us because he wants us to be with him. And rather than accepting and capitalizing upon his great sacrifice, we've rendered it for naught. Well, religious Jews have. We've rendered it for naught. Well, so have Christians. So have Muslims. This is written about Jews.
And it's chosen.
And there is really no reasonable, rational, appropriate reaction for God to have to his people for what they have done regarding denouncing the fulfillment of Pesach with Yosha as the Passover lamb, and then God's subsequent fulfillment of Matzah, than for him to resent them, for him to be disappointed, for him to show righteous indignation. Judaism is nothing but an irritant to God, as is Christianity and Islam. But without Judaism, there is no Christianity and Islam. The rabbinical observance of Pesach has become Keynesian. We've talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that religious Jews mimic the offering of Cain, which was comprised of vegetables. Yahweh rejected it in favor of the lamb presented by his brother Abel. Therefore, just as religious Jews universally denounce the role that Yosha served in fulfilling the serving Passover, they forgo the benefit of Pesach because they remain clueless as to its purpose. You cannot capitalize on God's means to provide eternal life if you do not recognize what God has done. You can't capitalize on the means to be perfected by God if you don't know how he went about doing that for you. Religious Jews talk about many things, but these are not things that they ever discuss. Matzah, as we know, is the threshold we cross to enter Yahweh's home. I began talking about Pesach as the doorway and Matzah as the threshold upon which, you know, you with a welcome mat, you would wipe your feet
mm-hmm,
and
yes.
symbolically be clean. Yes. I began talking about uh-huh. it that way probably 15 years ago. And
I was going to say, yes.
it was reassuring to read this in Yaketzel. Yahweh said, yeah, it's a pretty apt description. Matzah is the threshold.
You did that job. 15 years ago
yeah.
to me. I remember exactly.
Yeah,
well, that was when I started,
yeah,
almost 15 years ago.
Yeah, that is an advantage of studying Yah's Torah and prophets of coming to love Yahweh is that you begin after a while to think like him. I mean, okay, we don't think as well as he does or as deeply or know even one billionth as much, not even a billionth of a billionth of a billionth. But the whole purpose of his guidance and teaching is to share with us his thoughts. And the more we study his thoughts, his perspective, come to understand and appreciate his perspective and his approach, the more we begin to think like him. I mean, that's really the intent.
Yeah.
And so it's very clear after a while what the things that Yahweh was saying, what they mean to us, how to properly interpret them. And matzah has always seemed like the threshold we cross to enter Yahweh's home. It is the day Yahweh perfects us, removing the stench and stain of religion from our souls so he can adopt us on Bikurim. However, the rabbinical variation of unyeasted bread is so pathetic. Chak matzah is nothing but a missing ingredient. By having done both, rabbis have constructed a wall separating the victims of Judaism from Yahweh. Walls are good if they are protecting us as part of Yahweh's family. If Yahweh has built the wall and allows us inside, a wall's a good thing. A wall's a good thing to protect your family inside of a home. A wall's a good thing to protect your flock against beasts of prey. But a wall between us and God, that's a really, really bad thing. And God is saying here of Judaism that the rabbis have created a wall between God and his people. For the past 2,000 years, rabbis have precluded Jews from eternal life and from access to heaven. There's reasons that Jews don't talk about salvation, because there's no plan of salvation in Judaism. There's reason that Jews never talk about access into heaven, because they haven't a clue how to get there. There's a reason Jews deny the existence of hell, because far too many
don't
want to
go
that way.
Yeah.
So Judaism is just has written all these things out of the religion. It is part of the damage we are trying to undo in this, in our introduction to God and throughout Yada Yara. Kirk, I think it's impossible to overstate Yahweh's disgust with his people, because they have vandalized his name with their repulsive religion. Yahweh affirms his antipathy so often it is astonishing, really, that Jews continue to antagonize him. And so now we know why he wanted an independent witness, independent of Jews, very dependent on Yah, to write a witness called Yada Yahweh, to know Yahweh. Now, there are those who think that it is beneath God to get mad, that such base emotions are undignified, inappropriate, intolerant, immune, or immature, I should say, unenlightened and uncivilized. The only proper, informed, rational, and compassionate response to that which misleads, to that which is deceitful, destructive, deadly, or damning, is to oppose it. Be antagonistic towards it. Mm-hmm. I wish I could get this thought home as to why, you know, all we need is love is so stupid.
Ridiculous.
Well, what are you going to do? You're going to love the mass murderer? Do you think that loving a pedophile is going to cause the pedophile to stop inflicting such pain on children? Oh, if I could only love the rapist. What? You think that loving the rapist, forgiving the rapist, is going to cause a rapist to stop raping? Could you really be that stupid? Or is everything in the mindset of the progressive disjointed, out of context, irrational? We need to know what to hate, how to hate, mm-hmm. why to hate, if we're going to give love meaning. To help drive this point home, consider the following example. Let's suppose you came to know that a religious bridge between mortality and the promise of eternal life on the other side of a divide was unreliable. Indeed, that it had been deceptively designed and that it was deadly. Under those circumstances, if you knew that everyone who put their hope in that bridge was going to die,
mm-hmm.
would you warn people about it?
Of course.
Would you vehemently oppose it?
Absolutely.
Or would you be heartless and cowardly and despicable? I'll let them all go off to the life, because it's not politically correct to criticize a religious faith, well, particularly if that faith is Islam or progressivism or communism or some such thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the problem. We don't have people with real compassion, real courage, who are willing to say, no, this isn't right. Don't do this. You're squandering their life. They're lying to you. You know, and should those charging for passage across this faulty bridge outshout your warnings, piling one lie on top of another to lure the unsuspecting to their doom, would criticizing them be better than coddling them?
Good.
Since God is exposing and condemning rabbis, isn't it appropriate for us to echo his sentiments? Explain why?
Oh, thank you. Of course.
It
of
seems
course.
Pretty obvious to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hopefully
so
it's...
Why is the crowd so small? Is that obvious?
It's right. Not too little, too late. So then now, Ata, at this point, place, and time, I have chosen to sever the connection with them and to send them as far away as possible so as to avoid contact with them. Rakak, I want separation. I want disassociation from them. And I have decided to remove myself from their presence and distance myself from them with their unfaithfulness and their spiritual adultery, their harlotry and whoredom, their idolatrous immorality, as well as their monuments to their leadership's lifeless bodies. I want it all away from me. Only then will I dwell and remain in their midst for all eternity. Well, there's two aspects of this, Kurt. The first mm-hmm. is God has had too much religion from Jews. Religious Judaism started, it wasn't called Judaism at the time, but it might as well have been a religion of the Jews. Let's use Judaism as the religion of the Jews. They came out of Mitzrayim religious. And God, they were delayed in going into the promised land because they were religious. In the promised land, they did not listen, and they built shrines to pagan gods, and they sacrificed their children, mm-hmm. and they became ever more religious, which is why they were hauled away into slavery by the Assyrians and by the Babylonians. They became far more religious under Greek occupation, and it was their religion that brought the wrath of Rome upon them. It was their religion that Roman Catholics used against them. It was their religion that earned them the sword of Islam. Just like Biden has, as I said, when you've done everything wrong and nothing has worked and you continue to do what you have done that exacerbated the problem, causing more and more people to die, you would think after a while you'd say, this hasn't worked. Nothing I'm doing is working. So what if I do the opposite? Well, that's where we are with Judaism. God just said, I've had enough. I've had enough. We're dealing with 400 years of this?
Mm-hmm.
God said, I've had enough. So I can't take it anymore. Now, he made a promise, so he is going to reconcile his relationship with the people, but he's not going to do it through his people. Can't stand them anymore. So he solicited a goy to awaken them. Now, tonight I should mention on social media, and Dee is doing such a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. She's so devoted to this and given us such a wonderful presence in a medium that she is adept at that I can't stand personally. But I understand it's how vitally important it is to today's outreach.
So many.
Our outreach is to the Lone Star State of Texas today. So thank you, Dee, for arranging that. My wife is working hand in hand with her in this. And, you know, I can't compliment anyone without also thanking Jackie for what she's doing in terms of the publishing and the editing of our books. She and her team of editors, yes, and fact checkers, and also of David for the work that he has done to constantly improve what I think is just, well, I think it's probably from God's point of view, the best website in the world today at Yada Yah. So thank you all. So God is just saying, I can't handle it anymore. It's just too much. I want no more contact with my people. But there will be a remnant who will change in the end. And I think that's why Yeshaya 52 and 53 focus as they do on Yahweh's last witness, his messenger. Because even though he is insignificant to the story God's telling, if his people don't know what he has done and why he has done it, where and how he has done it, they can't capitalize on it. If they can't capitalize on it, they're unaware of it. They remain comatose, deceived by their religion, then reconciliations doesn't happen. The only way it's going to happen is for God to awaken his people, which is our purpose. So God is saying that I've chosen to sever my connection with them because they're unfaithful. They're committing spiritual adultery. God's statement that he etched in stone is, you know, you should not continually commit adultery. It has nothing to do with having more than one sexual partner.
No,
nothing.
Did.
Actually, God, yes, doesn't care. Look at Dode had what, 8 wives and 10 concubines. He loved Dode more than anybody else, called Dode right. So clearly, having more than one sexual partner is not God's concern as it relates to adultery. Abraham, same thing. Moshe, same thing. So that's not the problem, is it?
No.
The problem with religion, adultery, is cheating on God.
Yeah.
And that's all it is from God's perspective, is cheating on him, as well as the monuments to their leadership's lifeless body. when a religious Jew is trying to make a point, they cite their sages. They've got the names of all of them. They'll say, you know, the rabbi so-and-so, and they have a pet uh-huh. name for them all, too. You know, my favorite, of course, Akiba and Mamadis, yeah. but, you know, Akiba is, or Mamadis is the Rambam. But they all have the little pet names. You know, the founder of Hasidic Judaism is the Lord of the Good Name, Baal Shem Tov. All little pet names. They all cite them. Proof of them is this, that, and the other. I was reading an article the other day that posted the Jerusalem Post said that there have been some that think it's appropriate to teach the Torah by vocalizing the words, as if using the alphabet to pronounce what's there is an effective teaching method. Oh, no, what a terrible thing to do. That we ought to rely on the Masoretic and the history of the sages and what the tradition tells us that these words say. God forbid what we actually think. But they have turned those things to shrine. What was it, about a year ago that 150 or so Jews in mourning clothes, at least they were dressed appropriately, trampled over each other, stampeding
each other
because they were going to celebrate the anniversary of the death of, and I think in this particular case, it was the person wrongly ascribed credit for the Zohar, which is an ode to Satan. Good job, boys. They're constantly, that's why they love the Ukraine so much, they're constantly going to the grave sites of dead rabbis, honoring them.
Well, while you're talking about dead bodies, let me throw one little word in there just for fun for the thing. Pigger is the lifeless bodies. These are the people that we're talking about. And I like to have fun, obviously, with looking at the pictographs. And I'm always amazed at how well they describe what you're describing. So if you're looking for a secondary source to prove it, it's nothing better than the original letters, pictographs that were used in the original text. And Pegger means a corpse. If you look it up, it's a PGR or a Pei Gimel Rosh. And what's funny about it is when you look up the root, which is Pei Gimel, it's described as an inedible fruit, and it's also something that is unable to fill the role as intended. So I obviously, a corpse can't fulfill the role that's intended. You can't be a leader. But there's something, the minute I see a word like that where I see a gimel in the middle of it, it almost always is something terribly negative. And in this case, it proves to be so. It's an inedible fruit. So I decided, well, let's have a little fun. I'll find out where the first thing. We're going to talk about fruit and barber sheath. And we have, you still there?
Yes.
Okay. I had somebody trying to get on somehow. Okay. And so I was pausing to think about that, and I looked at a good fruit is a Pei Rosh Yod. And it's something that it's words that you observe that lift you up, where you have words that walk in the wrong direction that kill you. And the other word.
Of course, the forbidden for the fruit that's celebrated in Judaism is that Esau, that bitter piece of rind. I mean, I hate to even use the term fruit to depict it. This, if you could imagine a lemon without any juice, imagine a lemon where the peel or the rind of the lemon was 80% of the context, and that the juice was essentially bitter and non-existent, and it was ugly as sin. And you paid $500 to a rabbi to buy one. That's the fruit of Judaism.
Well, the only point I was trying to make, everywhere you look, when I'm looking at these, you can look at all the lexicons and you'll come up with the same thing if you have a brain that you write. And no one will write it as well, but honest to goodness. And once you see the picture and once you see what the words mean and once you see even what the letters mean, you can't escape what Yah's trying to say. This is not an option. This is what he's really saying. And it's been,
yeah, and it's pretty neat that that most recently through that lead tablet that was discovered, that it was written using the pictographic alphabet that is so descriptive. Yeah, you know, we've always longed to find something dated to the time of Moshe that was written using that alphabet, because you know Yahweh's name is a an arm reaching down and out with an open hand to us. The hey is a person standing up, reaching up to God. The Y is a tent peg, which enlarges and secures a home in the day. And so we were looking for something like that. For example, it's the Aleph, which was written all over that lead tablet, is a ram's head, which signifies the leader of the flock, the one with capable of protecting the flock. And so to find it dating back 3,400 years, echoing the very message of the Torah, found saying exactly what happened in the Torah, in the place where it said it happened, when it said it happened, it's exceedingly reassuring.
Very exciting.
Yes. So the end of this is interesting. It says, only then will I dwell and remain in their midst for all eternity. There's a happy ending. God is going to dwell and remain in the midst of Yisrael for all eternity. What is the triggering point? The elimination of Judah.
Those folks. Yeah.
Yeah. God said, I'm going to come back. I'm going to live in your midst forever. Wonderful news. All that has to happen for that to occur is the elimination of Judaism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. So rather than Judaism bringing Jews to God, rather than Judaism honoring God, Judaism is the very obstacle that exists between Jews and God.
That's the wall. Yeah.
Well, thankfully, it was not with all of them and only with those cheating on the relationship with religious and adultery that God is frustrated with. Thankfully, we are beginning to witness Yehudim denouncing the rabbis and returning to Yahweh. Now, this is all essential because Yahweh cannot live with his people until they have denounced their religion. This is the lone prerequisite for participating in the covenant and entering Yahweh's home. Therefore, Yahweh asked of his prophet, speaking to Yaketzel, Ezekiel, you, son of man, Ben Adam, tell this to the Christian church? Nope. To Muslims and the Fakistanians? I don't think so. To the progressives, since they are now in control of the White House and the United States of America. Nope. Tell this to the family of Israel. We're talking about the last days. Ezekiel is a prophet. He's talking about what's going to happen in the end. And God is still focused on the family of Israel, which means there is no justification for replacement theology, which means there's no basis for Christianity. And it's interesting that while the nation is called Israel, which is a transliteration of Yisrael, for the most part, the people who live there consider themselves to be Jews, not Yisraelites. And the Jews from Yahud represent only one of 12 tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So tell this, son of man, to the family of Yisrael. regarding the family home. We are prone to write temple. I occasionally say temple. I say Temple Mount, that sort of thing. But Yahweh refers to that building as a Beth. It's a family home.
You know, I had to go about 200 words to find it before it didn't say family originally. So they just totally have twisted it to make it that way.
You know, yes. There are some times where you see what is translated sanctuary and tabernacle sort of thing written. But Yahweh refers very consistently to what Dode purchased the land for and began to lay the cornerstone, and Solomon built, and that was rebuilt on the return from Babylon, and what will be reestablished upon his return as a Beth. Why? Because the covenant, Bereth, is based upon the family. So the family needs a home. And so what's there is the family home. It's, yeah, is it Yahweh's home? Yes, but it's our home too.
Yeah.
Our home too. The family home. So that they will be suitably embarrassed and shamed as a result of their perverse corruptions that they will eventually assess and reconsider this instructive example and paradigm. So when a prophet, according to God, speaks of the family of Israel and regarding the family home, that the religious should be embarrassed, they should be ashamed. And the reason is, God's always presented a very simple choice. You can be part of a relationship with him, or you can be religious, one or the other. And if you understand that he is attempting to establish a family relationship, if you've been religious, you're going to be embarrassed for having been so. Because, you know, in a religion, there is worship. In a family, there is none. In a religion, there are lords. In a family, there is none. In a religion, there are rules and laws and edicts and control mechanisms and hierarchies. Family home, there are none. The family works together for a common cause. They're entirely different constructs. And he says that the religious then will be embarrassed as a result of their perverse corruptions. That's what Judaism is. That's what Christianity is. It's what Islam is. It's a perverse corruption of the truth. And God is expecting, and I think largely because of what we are sharing, that eventually a meaningful number of Jews will reassess and reconsider the instructive example and paradigm that is being offered. The pattern of behavior that Yahweh is articulating is compelling. Well, this is really the purpose of a Nabi prophet. They reveal God, what God wants his people to know, especially about what is going to occur prior to his return. That's why we exist. We are a voice calling out in this wilderness of words to take the time, take a moment, and listen to what God has to say so that you're prepared for his return. Because after his return, it will be too late. You're not going to get a mulligan. There are no do-overs. It's now or never. And there just are not enough voices telling you the truth. And therein really is the purpose of these books, all of which were written to awaken Yehudim so that at least some are willing to return, to come to know Yahweh, to respect him in anticipation of his fulfillment of Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations. Yahweh has formulated his plan. He's articulated the pertinent details to Yisrael. Now he is announcing through these words, and those spoken through Yahshuah, through Hosea, through Zechariah, and many others, that a remnant of his people will become suitably embarrassed by this onslaught of rabbinical corruptions, that they will reassess his offer, reconsidering the means he has provided to capitalize the sacrifices he has made for us. Now, we have a couple of options regarding the proliferation of the pronoun hu, which is he, or hu, which is it, throughout what follows, as we turn to the next statement in Yaketzel. If he is intended, then this was scribed in Yaketzel's voice. If hu is to be translated it, then it would apply to the viet, the family home, which is masculine singular in the text. And it would continue in Yahweh's voice. And since it is typical for Yahweh's prophets to interject their assessment of what they are witnessing at poignant moments like these, I suspect that it is actually Yaketzel who is revealing what we're going to hear next. This reads, surely, a time will come when they will be embarrassed and ashamed for having been confused. Kalam, they are going to be despondent over having been perplexed and confounded regarding everything which, by association, they have done regarding the design and appearance of the family home and its living arrangements. During this stage of his journey, of him coming forth to withdraw, and of his arrival as a means to return to him, including all of his plans and arrangements, as everything was determined and delineated very long ago, comprising all of his appearances and outward manifestations, because everything was engraved in his clearly communicated prescriptions for living, pertaining to each appearance of I am, and how every aspect of the plan was fashioned and formed throughout the entirety of his Torah teaching and guidance. Just as you have chosen to make this known to them. God is telling us, I perceived a plan to rectify our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I told you about that plan. I promised you that I would fulfill that plan. I told you where I would honor my commitment. I told you when I would honor my commitment. I told you why I would honor my commitment, and I told you how you would respond rejecting what I have done. And then I went and did what I had promised to do. And then I empowered a witness to tell you what I did because you weren't listening. I've done all that for you. I've laid it all out. And yet you continue to ignore me, to frustrate me, to deny me. And you have a religion that is denying me the opportunity to form a relationship with my people. I hate you for it. God isn't just bothered by the rabbis. He despises them. They have precluded him from capitalizing on his great sacrifice on behalf of his people. They have precluded him from giving his people the gift of life and of perfection and of adoption. Yes, I am. Engraved in writing and clearly communicated everything about his plans, the arrangements that he has made. And he has made this known to his people throughout his Torah. It's a pretty powerful statement.
Gosh, I guess.
And now you know the purpose of the Torah. It's to convey what Yahweh is offering to his people, what he is giving and expects in return. Now, personally, I think that that statement reads best in the prophet's voice, with him assessing Yisrael's response to all that Yahweh has done for them. It serves to reinforce the realization that God's choice, or God's chose this man because of his intellect, because of his aptitude, because of his perspective. You know, I think that's, with maybe one or two exceptions, one notable one, most everybody God chooses to work with is perceptive. They are, they're quick studies. They're thoughtful individuals. They, I mean, the exception is Abraham. And with Abraham, I just think God didn't have a choice. Abraham's a scallywag. That's just
probably right, yeah.
But Abraham was the only one. Now, that's a little bit disheartening for someone like myself to say that, but that's true. Abraham was no jewel of a fellow. But there were no other fellows. So I guess in the land of the blind, one eyed man is king.
Start there,
that's the situation. I mean, it is uncomfortable, of course, for me to say that because I've devoted the last 20 plus years of my life, 10 hours a day, 6 and 7 days a week, to conveying God's message. And you know, there's the very distinct possibility that I was chosen for the same reason that Abraham was, which is there were just no other choices. But I prefer to think it's because, while I'm, you know, not claiming to be as smart as Moshe or Dode, at least, you know, my processor runs a little faster than the average dum-dum out there. So whichever way you want to look at it, for the most part, God likes working with people who are cerebral. There was a study done recently, just recently published, was spoken about by one of the top two or three psychologists in the world. And finally, someone did a study on what is the effectiveness of emotional responses versus thoughtful responses, judgment versus a feeling. And
thoughtful would be better. Yeah.
You know, the thought was that a very empathetic person, a person who feels deeply about their fellow man or woman, that they would correctly deduce what other people were feeling and thinking and what their motivations were and what they were likely to do, that the more sympathetic and empathetic a person was, the more attuned they would be to their fellow man. And the person who was strictly rational and logical and judgmental would not understand the motives and inclinations or would not be able to predict the behavior of people very well. Well, guess what they found? The person who responds emotionally is wrong almost all of the time.
I believe
that.
The
more empathetic you are towards others, the more likely you are going to misjudge them. And the more your response is based on evidence and reason, the more likely it is that you're going to get it right. And that's likely what God is communicating here. He recognizes that this awakening has to occur judgmentally. It's got to be...
Take some pressure.
Yeah. Based upon an informed choice and a decision that we make. It is likely that the prophet was encouraging us to think, and that if we think our way through this as opposed to just respond emotionally. And when I read the articles that convey the thoughts of rabbis today, it's just an emotional soup. They're just so tied up in their little underwears that they can't think at all. And that leads to horrible decisions. So the centerpiece of this awakening will be a new appreciation for the family of God and for Yahweh's home. Yahweh's long journey to make this possible, the arrangements he has made for us to join him, and his ongoing dedication to liberating us from the malfeasance of man's religious myths will punctuate and permeate his every teaching. And soon, his arrival will complete his plans as he returns to fulfill his promise that he made long ago. Incrementally, his every manifestation and representation draws away from religion and politics and unto the relationship with God. This reminds me of, Hitler would practice his speeches in front of a mirror with perfectly timed gestures. I think he looks like a clown personally, but I'm not fond of authority figures. And the tone of his voice and the like. And what I have found is that orators try to elicit an emotional chord, and that writers try to appeal to one's logic, their ability to reason. Yahweh's communication to us, Yahweh's from the very beginning, Yahweh's communication to his people has been in writing. He's appealing to their intellect, not to their emotions. Faith is emotional. Mm-hmm. Knowing is cerebral. God is communicating to us so that we can make an informed decision. Now, my personal relationship with God is based in large part on this proposition that is exposed in this passage. When I put all the pieces together, the most amazing picture emerged. I realized that Yahweh has served us in the forms of the set-apart spirit and of the Passover lamb. I came to appreciate the roles each aspect of God's nature played in the grand plan, which is the covenant. Indeed, the whole Torah exists for no other reason than to present and explain the benefits and responsibilities of this relationship. Mm-hmm. It's every word is fatherly advice to guide the children who ultimately will occupy the home that is Yaakov is describing. Now, personally, I like the verb yada. I named the whole series of books after yada, to know, to be familiar with, to acknowledge. Yahweh. And every bit of it's important. To know is to become familiar with. Knowing is a very powerful thing. But understanding is even more powerful. And yada means to know and understand, to become familiar with in a relational sense. It also means to acknowledge. And that's something that most people are afraid to do. It's one thing to know, vastly better to understand, but when we're dealing with Yahweh, he wants us to acknowledge him. So my relationship with God is, and I think yours, Kirk, is, and everyone that is part of our covenant family, is based upon what Yahweh has done for us and our appreciation for it as the Torah exists to explain it. Mm-hmm. We've come to God based upon evidence and reason.
Correct.
Every word of the Torah is perceived as heavenly advice. And yada has become our operative term. It's a verb. It's actionable. It is the means to know and understand God. Now, in this case, it was scribed in the second person. This is Yaketzel, therefore, addressing and affirming that Yahweh was correct and that this is indeed what God wants his people to appreciate about him. God wants us to know that he has a plan, that he enabled and fulfilled his plan, and that he is offering his plan to his people to capitalize upon. God wants us to know what he did on Pesach for us. He wants us to know what he did on Matzah for us, because what's the benefit of having made those great sacrifices unless your children benefit from them?
Sure.
That's what he's saying here.
It's common sense, yeah.
Yeah. Now, there is nothing more aggravating to a father than when he makes an enormous sacrifice for the benefit of his children, and his children ignore him or rebuff him. That's what Judaism has done. It's heartbreaking. Excuse me to go into the emotional, but it is. It's irrational, too. Also written under the auspices of the imperative mood, yada is Yahweh's choice, a demonstration of God's will. Now, as we move to the next statement, you can no longer apply to God. This means that either Yaketzel is addressing someone else, or Yahweh is now speaking to him or to another. Either way, God wants this written down, and he wants it shared with his people publicly, conspicuously, among those prepared to reconcile and reconsider, those who are willing to reject the rabbis during the last days. Powerful statement that follows, Kirk. It reads,
yes,
and so, therefore, of your own volition, actually write this down for them so that they can genuinely see it, such that they can choose to closely examine and carefully consider this, doing so continually and consistently, including everything pertaining to his plans and the arrangements he has made, as it was all determined in detail long ago, pertaining to each of his appearances and his manifestations, along with all of the clearly communicated written prescriptions regarding being cut into the relationship and receiving the share, so that they can act upon them and engage with them at that time. Yaketzel 43:11. Write it down.
Yeah.
Is he telling Yaketzel to write it down? Perhaps. Is he telling us to write it down? Perhaps.
Most definitely.
Is he telling both of us to write it down? Yeah. Write it down so they can see it. Because if you can read it, it will change your life. It will appeal to your mind. It will change your perspective. And if you can read it, you can observe it. You can examine it, and you can do so continuously and consistently, which you cannot do if it's a spoken word. A spoken word is like, you know, a vapor and breath reverberating through the air, and within
a moment
of the time it was spoken, it's gone. The written word. We're reading the written word of Yahweh, some of it revealed 3,400 years ago. Unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
Available to us over this chasm. But we can do what you love to do. Not only analyze each word, analyze each letter of each word.
Yeah. It's fun. actually.
Yahweh wants to constantly speak of his choke and chukah, which are the written communications.
Written
that,
down, yes. That's
right,
amazing,
that
yeah.
help us receive a share of what he is offering. Tell us how to live a fulfilling life. Why? So that we can wa'atza, act upon them, and engage based upon them. The purpose of writing all of this down is so that Yehudim, Jews, interested in returning to Yahweh, will have something to read, closely examine, carefully consider, especially pertaining to the most important decision in their lives. He wants Yehudim to understand his plan of reconciliation and the prescriptions for living that he has articulated so that they can act upon them, engaging in the covenant at that time. Yeah. We write, we study, we learn, we share on behalf of Yehudim. Yes, there are many, and there will continue to be many, goyim that choose to be part of the covenant based upon what we are learning and sharing. But ultimately, it's about reconciliations and bringing Yisrael and Yahudim together with Yahweh. And we're appealing to people's minds. Yehudim are the smartest people in the world. And they have the intellect, once they're free of the rabbis, to make this choice.
I think, yeah.
With his words, our Heavenly Father has painted a picture of heaven. He has revealed the complexity of his nature, and he has identified the characteristics of his family. He has explained who and what we will find, along with identifying who will be excluded, the religious, the political. And by sharing all of this in advance, Yahweh is expecting that a reasonable number of us will choose to be with him rather than against him. But at the very least, he is leaving all mankind without excuse. It's amazing how much God has actually told us and how little we as humans bother to think about it. This, Zoth, is the Torah teaching, instruction, directions, and guidance of the family home of the Almighty upon the summit of the first and foremost mountain of his extent and entirety of space-time, all around encompassing the entire surrounding environment, is the most set apart and special. Behold, this is the Torah guidance of the family home. So is the Torah a set of laws? How could you have a set of laws on a home?
You can't.
I mean, it's just so ridiculous. In a home, there is guidance. In a home, mm-hmm. there is instruction. You know, heck, my wife instructs me on how I should stay out of her kitchen.
She points, doesn't she, with a yacht.
You know?
Get out.
You know, a home is a place of instruction. That's what it, we want to guide, we want to instruct, we want to teach, we want to provide direction in our homes. If I laid down the law to my wife, well, that would
good
not very well. Yeah, good luck with that. Sleeping might be something you'd have to do with both
eyes. You're
too
smart. You're too smart for that.
You know,
man.
I don't even lay down the law with our fur-faced friends. With Wookiee and Asher. Homes are nurturing places, but a home is a lot more enjoyable if there's good conversation, if there's if we're learning together, we're growing together. But, you know, a home is a far cry from a place of worship. It's a very different from a place of devotion. It's not a place of making donations. And so God is saying, this is the Torah of the home, of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does God say is his family? It's the covenant. Bereth, yes. Based on Be'eth. So if you want to know how to be part of the covenant, take a moment and understand what God has just said through the prophet Yaakov. I have a family. This is my home. It has clearly communicated instructions on how you could become part of it. My home is set apart and special, which means it's the antithesis of that which is popular, which means it is most certainly not religious or political. Simple things with a profound meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I happen to personally love Kirk. Behold, henna. Pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Zoth, Torah. Ha, Be'eth. Behold. Pay attention. This is the Torah guidance, the source of teaching, instruction, and direction of the family home.
Well, here's two little things that... Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, what more could you want to be part of Yahweh's family? What more could you want than to enter his home? And if God provided, which he says he did, the Torah to guide us there, to teach us about it, what could be more important than the Torah?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, and if, by the way, if the Torah exists to guide us to and to teach us about Yahweh's family home, then why do we need a Talmud? Why do we need a New Testament? Why do we need a Zohar? What's the purpose of those things? Why are there Jewish laws? Why is there a kosher diet? What's the purpose of any of this? If the Torah exists to tell us about Yahweh's home. It seems so utterly simple. You know, the covenant represents Yahweh's family. It is our opportunity to enter God's home. It's the only means to enter. And it's all laid out for us in the Torah. We become part of his family through the covenant, of which there are five conditions and five benefits. The benefits of the covenant are delineated in and capitalized upon by answering the invitations to meet with God seven times a year. These things go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
As a family, God wants to be our father. He wants to adopt us as his sons. He does not want to be worshipped. He has no laws. He most certainly does not want to be feared. And last time I checked, there was no reason to ever pray to a dad.
No.
Well, that's where we are. Why is it so confusing for so many? Yahweh said to me, son of man, place it upon your heart, which means consider this rationally. Look with your eyes, which means to be observant. And listen with your ears, which is the means to be receptive. To everything which for the benefit of the relationship I have spoken to you. Concerning all of the clearly communicated prescriptions, the inscribed recommendations and written requirements of what should be done in life to live in Yahweh's family home. With all of his Torah teachings and directions, you should examine them using your best judgment in order to enter the family home and with regard to everything associated with this stage in the journey to the set-apart place. I can guarantee you, as powerful as that statement is, Kirk, we're going to begin the next week's program just focusing on everything you can glean from this. But this is the summation of God's message to us. Yahweh, God's one and only name, said to me, said to you, said to us, said to Yisrael, children of Adam, put your heart. Consider this. Think about it. In your best judgment, ponder it. Exercise good judgment. Look with your eyes. Be observant. Listen with your ears. Be receptive. What to? Something I said? No, to Eth Kol Asher. Everything which, for the benefit of the relationship, Dabar Eth Ata, I have spoken to you. Well, that would include the entire Torah. Beginning with Bereshith, which tells us of why God created the universe, how he created it, what we experienced with God in Eden and why we're returning there, why God became frustrated with religious and political man and found favor with Noah and work together to create an ark to celebrate life and to start again. Such that with Abraham, he found a way that we could return to Eden, giving us the opportunity to become part of his family again. With the living exemplar of everything that is right with God, being established in your 3,000 Yah with Dod, the Messiah, the King, the Shepherd, while fulfilling what he was promising in your 4,000 Yah with the fulfillment of the first four Mikre. Observe it. Listen to it. Think about it so that you can be part of the relationship. Not some of what I have spoken, all of it, including the fulfillment of Teruah, where we reach out and share God's message so that there is a day of reconciliation and that we can all camp out together for 1,000 years thereafter. Living in and as part of God's family and home. That's all there is to it. The universe exists, the earth exists, the Torah exists, Yisrael exists, the prophets exist, we exist as humanity.
There's one purpose.
All to be part of Yahweh's covenant family, to live as part of his home. Whether there is just one of us, as the case with Adam, two of us, in the case with Adam and Chawa, three of us in the case of Adam, Chawa, and Abel, Hebel. One of us in the case with Abraham. Two of us in the case of Abraham and Sarah. Three of us in the case of Abraham, Sarah, and Yishak. We are all given this opportunity to be part of God's family. And that's why it all exists. There's nothing more to the story than that. Yahweh wants to be dad. This Ruach Kodesh wants to be mom. They want to raise us, lift us up, teach us, guide us, protect us, lead us, nourish us, love us, give us life, give us every opportunity, enjoy forever together. That's the story of the Torah. There's no religion here. There's no laws here. There's no prayer, no worship. It's a lovely story about a God who is approachable, likable, knowable. And I don't get the religious thing, Kirk. Why would you worship someone who wants to lift you up, who wants to enjoy a family-oriented relationship? Why would you interject laws into a home? No. Why turn something so simple into something complex? Why replace knowing with faith? Why prefer belief over understanding? I don't get it. Why any of this? I know Yahweh's dad. We have a working relationship. God is keen on, he chose to work with Adam. He chose to work with Noah. He chose to work with Moshe. He chose to work with Samuel. He chose to work certainly with Dode. And he went to work with his prophets. Working with Yahweh is a good gig. Sure, we work together. Get right to the basics of it. We are father and son. He's my dad. He's the dad that I didn't get in life. She's my mom, the mom I didn't get in life. I'm their kid. Yeah, dad's proud. We've done a lot. There's more to do. Very few things in life are as rewarding as making dad proud. We're about the family business. It's a wonderful place to be. We should all embrace it. There is no reason to cling to religion when it offers nothing but false hope and makes your life miserable and steals your money and steals your freedom when God is offering you complete and utter liberty. Freely becoming part of his family. It's a very simple story that we have corrupted and convoluted. And God, frankly, is fed up with us having corrupted, twisted, convoluted his story. He wants it back simple again. This is the Torah of the family, he says. Is there a better, more clear, powerful statement than that? This is the Torah of the family. This is the direction of the family. This is the teaching and guidance of the family. And so with all of his Torah teaching and directions, you should examine them using your best judgment in order to enter the family home. That is what we're teaching. That is what Yahweh is teaching. That's what he wants his people to know. It's not complicated. It costs you nothing. It gives you everything. So on this final day of Chag Matzah,
yes,
we transition into this wonderful seven sevens between Chag Matzah and Shabuah.
Shabuah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, looking forward to the enrichment and enlightenment of that time so we can be more effective troubadours and witnesses on Teruah to encourage Yahweh's people to reconcile the relationship on Kippurim so that there's even more of us to camp out on. Yeah, this is the only place, Kirk, where, when a rich uncle or parent dies and if there is one sibling that inherits it all, then they're elated. But if that rich uncle or parent chooses to divide the estate between 10 kids and 20 grandkids and other associated wives and hangers-on, then we're all received less. Well, this is the one place where the more the merrier. If we have 1,000 brothers and sisters, that's the experience will be far richer for us. We will actually inherit more than if there were 100. And just as if there are 10,000 or 100,000, our inheritance actually increases in every possible way.
exponential.
The more children there are in God's family.
Yeah.
So we
what a beautiful
we hope
presentation.
For all of you.
I mean, wow.
Well, my friend, unless you've got something you wish to conclude based upon a word that you've studied or something to
where you're leaving off will be good next week. I'm going to put it together a little better, and I'll send it to you.
Okay. We will recommence right here, in Yaketzael as we are very close now to concluding this chapter, and then we'll see where the Spirit leads as to where we go next. I can tell you that we have entered a time where the clarity of God's message, the passion, the intellect, the story that God is telling us, and the way that we're able to interpret it is so far beyond anything we've experienced in the past. It almost doesn't matter where we turn.
This is just
teaching, learning, instruction.
This is good.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
All right. So we will return here this time next week. We'll probably go ahead and complete the introduction to God and go through the last chapter of it, since we're at this particular place, and then look forward to where we turn from there. May Yahweh bless. Have a wonderful conclusion of Chag Matzah if you are further west than we are here in the Atlantic time zone. And if not, then I hope that the afterglow of Chag Matzah continues to be with us all. May Yah bless. Good night.
Good night.